unrelentlessly positive.
Innovative.
Innovative?
Innovative. Whatever.
It indicates.
Indicative?
Hey, can we focus?
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. This is the 11 o'clock hour on a less smoky Friday. We're happy to be able to breathe a little bit better than we've been able to. So hopefully that continues to clear out over the weekend. And now that we've gotten through the first hour, we thought that we might actually try to break down and discuss some of the, I guess, the three kind of biggest cases that everyone thought would be the finale to this year's Supreme Court session. And so we have asked Professor Howard Schwieber, who is a professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, to join us. He's an expert in constitutional law, judicial politics, free speech. And also, according to his bio, he makes great omelets and tells jokes that are much funnier than people realize.
Well, that's wonderful.
Professor, you and I have that in common.
Well, I appreciate that.
Well, welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you. So I guess yesterday it seemed like you were very busy. I think I saw you pop up on a lot of people's coverage of the affirmative action case. So let's start with that one. And so sure. What are the actual implications? And does it matter at all as far like public versus private schools? But like what?
Right.
Where does this lead? And is this vague or is it pretty definite?
It's extremely vague.
Okay, great.
The opinion starts out with a grand, strong, sweeping statement. Colleges may not use race as a factor in admissions. Blanket principle. And that applies to public institutions, and it applies to private institutions that receive public money. So Harvard was a party in the case because Harvard receives a lot of federal research funding, and there are federal statutes that say if you accept federal funding, one of the conditions of that is you have to comply with all the rules that apply to public institutions. The problem is that late in the opinion, there's a gigantic loophole. Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the opinion, says, of course, any individual student can talk about their life experience and how their racial identity has affected their life experiences, and colleges can take that into account, which seems like a loophole that swallows the rule.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is a kind of shift. That is, the burden shifts from the college admissions officials to the student. Colleges can't give a blanket preference based on race, but any individual student can accept the burden, so to speak, of explaining how their status as a racial minority has affected them, and then colleges can pay attention to that. That's incredibly ambiguous because it's not at all clear how those two things work. Is there a limit to how much weight a college can give to that factor? Can colleges treat essays that cite experiences of racial minorities as presumptively better evidence of overcoming adversity than other essays? If you imagine a lawsuit, and there will certainly be lawsuits, you can imagine a judge being asked to read every application essay from every applicant in a given year in order to decide whether the college has been treating those application essays that mention race differently from those that do not. If you're a college admissions officer at this point, you know what you can't do? You have to get rid of the procedures in place that assign, usually it's points. Usually race is one among numerous factors that are used to weight the evaluation of an application. You have to get rid of that system, but it's not at all clear what you can do to replace it. It's also not clear what this means for things like DEI programs on campus. The case only involved admissions, but what about race-targeted programs to help students succeed once they are on a campus? Mm-hmm. Are those now unconstitutional? And the answer is nobody knows. The last thing that nobody knows is there are already lawsuits percolating, making the claim that neutral, what look like neutral programs, like the famous Texas program guaranteeing admission to the top 10% graduates of every high school, those kind of alternative programs should also be declared unconstitutional if they have the effect in practice of increasing minority representation because they are de facto racial preferences. So no one knows how far this goes. No one knows what acceptable practices now look like. We have a very clear statement about one thing that's not acceptable, the old kind of check the box mechanism, right?
Yeah.
It's an automatic preference if you check a box for racial identity. But beyond that, it's extraordinarily ambiguous. And I have to add one more comment. I know I'm rambling, but
no, this is great.
The students who will be most disadvantaged by this are the students we most want to reach. If you're a minority student who goes to a private high school or a well-funded public high school, you will have a college admissions counselor.
Mm-hmm.
You might have savvy parents who understand how college admissions work. If you're wealthy, your parents might hire you an admissions tutor. And in fact, this is not a joke, you might even use ChatAPT to write an essay for you.
Yeah.
If you're a student at a poor school, you're unlikely to have a college counselor. Your teachers and administrators are unlikely to be able to walk through this kind of complicated set of what is, and you know, how to craft an essay that in a permissible way appeals to what colleges are looking for. And so it's the poor and underserved minority students who are most cut out. It is made most difficult to reach them by shifting the burden from the college to the student. And that's tragic, because obviously those are the students who we most would like to be able to reach.
Absolutely. And who also have the most to gain to be the, you know, first generation college students. And but they
of
don't
course.
Necessarily have someone like their parents signing them up for ACT courses.
Right.
Yeah. And so this is kind of an outlandish question. We're talking to Professor Howard Schweber, who is a professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. Because I know, you know, is there any constitutional or legal standing to ever challenge the preference that like legacy students get at some of these colleges, and like the over admission of people who, it's not merit, it's their family's donations or their family's legacy. Is there legal standing that if anyone ever wanted to make a lawsuit about that, they could?
Yeah, the answer is probably not. although there the question is less law than politics. I'm hopeful that one consequence of this decision will be a renewed attention to the politics of college admissions. And particularly things like legacy admissions. So one of the parties in this case was Harvard. Fully a third of Harvard's entering class are either recruited athletes, and keep in mind we're talking about sports like tennis and crew. Recruited
mm-hmm.
athletes are 85% white. Legacies, children of alumni, who are again overwhelmingly white, and children of donors. So a third, and among those groups, the admission rate is around 45%. The admission
wow.
rate for the general population is around 6%.
Wow!
So a third of the class, right, and a third of the entire class is made up of students who are overwhelmingly wealthy and white, come from overwhelmingly privileged backgrounds, and have a gigantic advantage in admissions. That's not unconstitutional, because none of the things I just said specifically say we're admitting you because of your race. But as a matter of policy and politics, I think your reaction illustrates just how startling people find it when they realize how powerful the pro-white affirmative action programs are that are in place, as compared to the much, much smaller program that just got struck down.
That's good. Yeah.
For comparison, approximately 9% of the Harvard student population, undergraduate population, is black.
Wow. So then my final question before I want to move on to some of the rulings that came down today, what does this mean for, because it seems like there is, we can declaratively say there's a war on DEI, right? Like there is on ESG, on DEI. We've seen it with the debates with the UW system. But what does this open, what does yesterday's ruling open up for like corporate, in the corporate world, as far as like their initiatives that they've recognized are good for business? And how many lawsuits this opens up to what businesses can or cannot do when their private companies are hiring.
Right. So it shouldn't. Private companies are not bound by the Constitution.
Okay.
So there's something called the state action doctrine that says that things like the Equal Protection Clause or the Free Speech Clause or other clauses of the Constitution only apply to limit what governments may do. On the other hand, and again, you have to kind of read the law along with the politics. You can certainly read this case as an encouragement to state legislatures, like the Florida legislature, for example, that might want to pass laws cracking down on DEI practices. And if a company then challenges one of those laws, Florida would come back and point to this case and say, no, we're just carrying out the spirit of the Constitution. I don't know if that's a winning argument. The companies will argue that their free speech rights are being infringed upon. It's a mess. But much more immediately, the case is written in very, very broad language. Right? The specific issue had to do with college admissions, but it's written much more broadly than that in the early paragraphs. This case will be used, I can pretty much guarantee it, as a basis to challenge preferences in hiring, federal contracting, pretty much any public action that is explicitly race conscious. So think about, I think I've already mentioned this, DEI type programs on college campuses. Can now, and I'm sure will be, challenged under this precedent. And frankly, we have no idea how those challenges will work out.
Well, and that's even not that they've not filed a lawsuit, but the Common Council in Milwaukee was talking about kind of the strings that have come attached to the potential of the sales tax being the city of Milwaukee can't have any DEI programs. And so, would that fall under this as well?
No, that's a different set of issues.
Okay.
I mean, the problem is there's so many issues here. what can a state government do or a city government to regulate private businesses? What can the state government do to limit what cities can do? Each of these is a different sort of constitutional category.
Okay.
The short answers, although none of this is well worked out, is that states can control cities because cities are considered administrative subunits of the state.
Okay.
And states cannot regulate private businesses in ways that would infringe on those private businesses' freedom of expression. And I'm afraid that's sort of all I can tell you right now, because that's all that we're sure about.
It's almost like none of this is black and white or straightforward or simple.
How remarkable. I refer to this as the Lawyers Full Employment Act.
Ah, seriously.
Really?
That is a very good... See, you are funny. We're talking to Professor Howard Schwimmer, who is a professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will get quickly to today's rulings about student loans and the wedding website that maybe there was never a real request in the first place. But stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
I had a chat with Ho Chi Minh, sipped rice wine and chased him with gin. Won't take long, that's a miss my guess. I have you out of this doggone mess. I set up cable to Bali and Mac. Let them know I'm coming back. Sit right down with Rockin' Nicks. Teach them both some of Pygmy's tricks. You son of a gun, you. Come November election time. You vote your way and I vote mine. Case is a tie and the money gets spent. Vote for Pygmy, not for president. I am the judge. I am the judge. Everybody knows that I am.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matner. And on the phone with us, we have Professor Howard Schwaber, who is a professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he is helping us make sense of the Supreme Court rulings that came out yesterday and today. So let's start off, Professor. What can we make out of the student loan ruling as far as what this... I mean, it seems pretty straightforward. It's just what we thought was going to happen is just not going to happen now.
Well, that's right. It's unfortunately not straightforward because these things are never straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
So if we back up just last year, there was a case called West Virginia versus EPA. And that had to do with the question of what is the scope of the executive power with respect to executive agencies, regulatory agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, for example. And in that case, the Roberts Court kind of doubled down on an idea that they had introduced earlier but never really explicitly worked out, which is the major questions doctrine, which says that if the executive is going to do something really big, and this is true of the executive generally, so it applies to the president as much as it applies to an agency. If the executive is going to do something that involves, I should be specific, spending money in a really big way, then Congress has to have specifically authorized that use of money. This is because all spending must originate in the House of Representatives according to the Constitution, so Congress has special authority where spending money is involved. So this is a separation of powers argument. The difficulty is, of course, that there's no definition of what really big is. It's whatever the Supreme Court happens to think it is at a given moment. In this instance, this was, let me speak in defense of the Roberts Court for a moment, the most expensive executive order ever issued. That is, taken on its face just in terms of dollar value effects. And what the court said was, no, for the president to have that kind of authority, Congress has to have said so explicitly. Biden was relying on a law that gave the president, and Trump had used the same law, emergency powers because of COVID to suspend student loan payments. Biden was saying, well, this same law also gives me authority to wipe out all of these student loan payments to the tune of, you know, an enormous amount of money. And the court said, no, you're overreaching. It's not clear that Congress in that law intended to give you that authority. So this goes much more to the general question of separation of powers mm-hmm. and how specific Congress has to be in granting authority to the executive than to the particular question about the student about student loans. The politics is interesting because historically, one of the things Congress has always done is given executive agencies fairly vague descriptions of their authority, precisely in order that Congress and its members can avoid the political consequences of coming out strongly and saying, yes, I'm authorizing this, or no, I'm not authorizing that. So one way to read what's going on here is that the court is trying to hold Congress's feet to the fire and force them to step up. Given the current dysfunction in Congress, this likely results in a general disempowerment of the executive branch to carry out various functions of government.
Okay, so this is... So is there long-term ramifications of this, or is this something that, like, it's kind of just as we have this Congress right now and this president right now, it'll continue to be vague?
Sure. The long-term implication is, and I think this is the goal of particularly some of the justices, such as Gorsuch, for example, is to weaken the executive branch, weaken the agencies and the regulatory agencies that pass the rules that, you know, govern the environment and food safety and road safety and all sorts of things like this. Think about how much political hay Republicans have made about the idea that Democrats want to ban gas stoves. Democrats have never wanted to ban gas stoves. But this idea of the overreaching executive branch is a favorite cause of political conservatives, and the court has now given very significant support to that goal of reining in the regulatory state.
But isn't it, and maybe I'm just kidding, maybe I watched Vice one too many times, but wasn't this like during, but like in the early aughts of like W's reign, wasn't there the opposite swing of trying to give the executive branch so much power? So is this just kind of the pendulum going back the other way?
No, it's again, unfortunately, a little more complicated than that.
Okay.
We like to try and simply say, you know, liberals like X, conservatives like Y. And then we get a little more complicated and say, well, when we're talking about the Constitution, we mean judicial conservatives and judicial liberals. It's much worse than that. So judicial conservatives, and I think political conservatives generally, like a very strong president in foreign affairs, military affairs, security and police affairs, but want a weak executive branch, including the president, in domestic economic affairs. Liberal progressives tend to want the opposite.
Got it.
You can say the same about Congress or state legislatures, for that matter. Conservatives tend to want governments to be very powerful in, well, for example, regulating abortion. Just take one out, you know, very recent example that's obviously in many people's minds. But to be much less powerful in regulating economic activities and businesses. And liberals and progressives tend to want the opposite. So there really isn't a straightforward who likes big government, who likes small government. It all depends on what government is trying to do.
Shocking how that works out.
Yeah.
Well, Professor, I know we only booked you for this for half hour. Do you have to go or could we bring you back? Because I still want to talk about the wedding site and we didn't even get to that and we have to go to commercial.
No, I'm happy to come back.
Awesome. Because this one feels bananas to me, considering that the website may be based on a lie. And yet now we have a ruling in favor of the website designer. So I can't wait to hear your take on this. So we are talking to Professor Howard Schwaber, who is a professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about, we just touched on yesterday's ruling and today's ruling on student loans. When we come back, we're going to talk about the free speech wedding website designer and whether or not it was a real request or not, but it is now law. So stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere, and we are very grateful that our guest is sticking around with us to talk about this last ruling that came out today. Our guest is Professor Howard Schwaber, who teaches political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he's an expert in constitutional law, judicial politics, and free speech, which is exactly what this case about the website designer is dealing with. And so the Supreme Court ruled today in favor of an evangelical Christian web designer from Colorado who refuses to work on same-sex weddings in a decision that deals with a setback, I would say, to LGBTQ rights. So, Professor, what does this one mean?
Yeah, this one is complicated. And it's particularly complicated because Justice Gorsuch wrote the opinion, tried to make it simple. And sometimes trying to make complicated things simple is the opposite of helpful.
Yeah.
So let's start with a really basic principle. The government cannot compel you to express something you don't believe in. The original case about this back in the 1950s was that students may not be compelled to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And it had nothing to do with religion. The actual case involved a kid who was a Jehovah's Witness, but the decision was purely about speech. You can't compel expression. Flash forward. This web designer claims that being forced to comply with an anti-discrimination law because of the nature of her work involves compelled expression. So, for example, supposing you had an actor who hired himself out to do voiceovers for commercials. Somebody wanted him to do a voiceover for a commercial that espoused a political position he didn't want. The government shouldn't be able to force him to do that ad. That's the argument. The tricky parts, there are at least three tricky parts here. Number one, is this web designer's work a matter of expression? Is this the equivalent to an actor being forced to say lines, you know, that he finds philosophically odious? And they said that it was, but to reach that conclusion, they relied on some very specific facts. This particular web designer said, and the court accepted, that any celebratory website she established would have her own personal commentary in it at the end, explaining how much this means to her. And that made this web design business a matter of personal expression. What that doesn't clarify at all is what if there wasn't that very specific circumstance? Do you remember the Masterpiece Cake Shop case out of Colorado a couple of years ago? And that raised this very question. The baker claimed his cakes were self-expression, even though there weren't words on them. He claimed that anyone seeing these cakes used at a same-sex wedding would say, aha, the baker who made these cakes is expressing support for same-sex marriage, and therefore being required to make the cakes would require him to express this view that he didn't hold. On the facts of that case, that seems kind of tenuous. Here, it seems like they carefully cherry-picked a case where, you know, because of these very specific facts where the web designer says, I would always put my own words in my own paragraph at the end, and that's why this is expression. And Gorsuch leaned in on that to connect this to that bedrock principle against compelled expression. What this means for future cases that don't have those particular facts is completely unclear.
Well, and that's the thing. I don't know how much you've followed this, because I think it came out pretty late, but this whole case feels very cherry-picked. Like everything that it seems like the details as far as when she first put up, like everything around this person, like how many websites she's even made or how many she had made when the case first was filed.
Yep.
And also the fact that the Republic reported this week that the person supposedly that made the request, no one ever called this guy to feel like, who was he?
Yep.
And then they finally did. And the guy's married to a woman and is also a graphic designer who lives in San Francisco. So like if this is all true, how did the Supreme Court just rule on a case where there wasn't even an actual request or like a conflict?
Well, that gets to the second weird thing about this case, which is what lawyers call standing. Usually to bring a case, you have to show that you have something at stake, that you're involved somehow, that you're not just like an imagined case brought by a fictional character, right? You have to show you're a real person who's at risk of suffering a real harm and you have a stake in the outcome. In recent years, the Roberts Court has made a hash of standing rules. They have accepted cases that previous courts would never accepted in order to reach questions they wanted to reach.
Yeah.
This one takes it to the level of caricature. Not only does it appear to be, and you're right, this is new, so I certainly can't say that I'm sure it's true, but not only is there reporting claiming there never was such a customer, but it's very clear when the case was originally filed, she had not yet gone into the business of designing wedding websites. This is purely sort of aspirational. I hope to design wedding websites. When I do, I hope to add paragraphs of my own speech. When I do that, I expect to be hired by someone to create such a website for a same-sex wedding. I expect the state of Colorado to compel me to create that website. And if they were to do that, that would violate my constitutional rights. They're on the basis of this gossamer line of speculation, the court accepted the case.
And
which
this
only tells you how much they wanted. I mean, this is the follow-up to Masterpiece Cake Shop. They've been waiting for a case in which they could easily and clearly rule in favor of a religious person without mentioning issues of religious liberty. In other words, they wanted to make this about free speech, but in a way that specifically protects the prerogatives of religious individuals. The ruling, by the way, is not limited to religious individuals. When you make this about free speech rather than about freedom of religion, it follows equally that the same web designer could refuse to do websites for weddings that involve a Democrat marrying a Republican, or Democrats or Republicans, or short people, or anything else, as long as he can say, well, I have a strong view that I disapprove of this, and you can't make me express a contrary view through the conduct of my business.
So it's opening the door. It's just opening the door for all kinds of discrimination.
Absolutely. So now this is the third strange part of the opinion. I mentioned there were three. There are two questions now for future cases. So I get up and I say, listen, I run a business. I design websites. I should not be required to make a website celebrating a wedding that involves Catholics. Two questions have to be answered. One, do I genuinely have a belief that weddings, or let's say an interreligious marriage between a Catholic and a Protestant, do I genuinely have a belief that that's wrong? That is, am I genuinely being asked to express something that I disagree with? How carefully will a court examine my beliefs? This gets us back to the religion issue, because when people claim religious prerogatives, one of the things they have to claim is that they have a sincerely held religious belief. They're not just making it up for purposes of a lawsuit. Well, we will now have to ask that same question in a variety of contexts. So that's one. The other piece is, as I mentioned, this case has very specific, possibly made up, but very specific facts having to do with a web designer who, you know, puts a paragraph of her own words in each website, et cetera. What will this do when we get back to Masterpiece Cake Shop? What will this do when someone claims what I do is expressive? What's the test? What's the test for whether the baker's wedding cake really expresses the message that the baker approves of the wedding? The old test until now has been reasonable observer. Would a reasonable observer attending this wedding, seeing this cake, say, aha, this baker is expressing support for same-sex marriage? Or would the reasonable observer draw no such connection? But in both this case and the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, the Roberts Court has increasingly moved toward something that looks a lot like we will take their word for it.
Yeah.
So it's all about this question of deference. If you take the person's word for it that they have a sincerely held belief, and you take the person's word for it or adopt their perspective that what they're doing is an expression contrary to that belief, then you have indeed opened the door to a wide range of discrimination.
And Professor Schwaber, I just don't understand how it's even legal to rule on hypotheticals.
Well, that's that standing question. Under the U.S. Constitution, as interpreted by the courts in the past, you're exactly right. Hypothetical cases were never supposed to be ruled upon. You had to have, they're what's called advisory opinions, opinions that say, well, if this were to happen, our advice is. In our system, the federal courts aren't supposed to rule on those questions. All I can say is that, you know, there's a lot of criticism of the Roberts Court from various angles, people who disapprove of their rulings or their ideology or disagree with their philosophy. One area that's extraordinarily clear is that with respect to standing questions specifically, that is, with respect to the ability of the court to manipulate its docket to reach issues it wants to reach and ignore issues it doesn't want to reach, this court has been, it's difficult to overstate how unprincipled this court has been in the application of those rules.
And for someone who is a constitutional, like, legal scholar, and I'm sure in your work and your colleagues, like, people run the gamut. As you say, there's judicial conservatives and judicial liberals. Like,
sure, of course.
When you talk to your colleagues, regardless of what their political ideology is, does everyone just kind of be like, this is bonkers?
So this is why I was focusing so much on that standing question, right? On the standing question, yes. You don't have to be a liberal or a conservative or anything else to recognize that taking this case is just contrary to 50 years of established practice and even contrary to what this court says that it's doing. On the other issues, of course, it's much less clear. There's always room for philosophical disagreement on the meaning of the Constitution and how it plays out. One thing that is agreed to across the board are two things, actually. One, these cases are dramatically rewriting decades of jurisprudence. Now, that could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your philosophy,
yeah.
But they're certainly radical. The second thing is they're really ambiguous. They give very little guidance, very little clear guidance to people on the ground, whether you're an agent working for an anti-discriminatory discrimination agency or a college admissions counselor, you know, or a baker, whatever. It's very little clear guidance to people on the ground of what is and is not permitted. And so a lot of this is, it's a strange combination of simultaneously very radical, but very unclear. And that's a combination that basically invites much, much more litigation.
Wow. So I guess my final question for you, Professor Schwaber, since you are a professor, what grade would you, like, taking all the rulings in from this this past year's cases for the Supreme Court, what grade would you give the Supreme Court for their interpretation of the law?
That doesn't really work. Yeah, the problem is that doesn't work because the grade ordinarily would be how accurately and thoughtfully and carefully have you interpreted, you know, existing precedents. These guys are making this stuff from whole cloth. I tell you what, though, if I were teaching a course in, let's say, logic, and I was asked to grade this work in terms of its coherence and its rigor, a high D.
Wow. A high D.
High D in
high
logic.
D. Okay.
Well, yeah, no, I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. It's a high D.
And, Professor, I just think, speaking of bonkers, Clarence Thomas going on $500,000 trips around the world, Gorsuch, his cabin that he sold for an extra $2 million after he got on the bench. That is just seems nuts to me.
Well, it's even more nuts than you may or may not realize. So, again, several things going on. The one that is the most disturbing is that there appears to be a pattern, and it really seems very clear, that through the Federalist Society and its head, Leonard Leo, what is happening is that effectively conservative justices, once they take the bench, are being assigned a benefactor, assigned a billionaire who takes care of them and takes them to dinners and takes them on trips. And it's really an organized effort of some sort is what it looks like. I know that's a weird statement. But, for example, Harlan Crowe, the guy who was involved with Clarence Thomas's actions, has a painting on his wall of himself, Thomas, and Leonard Leo. The guy who took, you know, Alito up to Alaska has had multiple social interactions with Alito, never knew him before he became a justice. But once he became a justice, was suddenly all over the guy. So this is... it's fascinating because I think the justices are extraordinarily tone deaf on how this plays politically. They keep coming up these legal defenses. Well, we're not required not to take these gifts because the ethics rules don't legally apply to us, which is true. The Supreme Court has ruled that there are no ethics rules that apply to the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court says so. And having said that, they are therefore not bound by any such rules. These things they're doing would be a violation of rules for any government official, any police chief, you know, let alone any lower court judge. But none of those rules apply to the Supreme Court. So on the one hand, there's an amazing arrogance and an amazing insularity in the way they're defending themselves by saying, well, we're not legally required to do so. And effectively, how dare you ask us to?
Jeez.
That is complying with ethics rules.
Professor,
and on the other hand,
Professor, I have to cut you off because we have 20 seconds left. But this was wonderful. We cannot wait to have you back. You were fascinating. And Professor Hayward, Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thank you so much for your time today. We got to take a break and then we'll wrap up the show.
Ooh, rockin'.
to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. Are you still dumbfounded by what Professor Schwaber told us?
I didn't have enough time to find a song about... My mind is blown. This is just insane. Think, our Supreme Court justices get a billionaire handler when they get on the court. Think about that. They're accountable to no one except the people who are taking them on $500,000 trips. It's just, and they are lifetime appointments. We're stuck.
There's so many things. It is. Doesn't it feel like, to a certain extent, and I've used this term before, but it's like, in certain ways, it feels like we're hostage. Sometimes it's like in Wisconsin, because this didn't really make, I feel like a lot of people didn't necessarily talk about this, but on Wednesday, the Democrats in the Senate brought to the floor to a motion to, or like a bill to repeal the 1849 ban, and all 22 Republican senators voted against it.
Of course.
And I mean, that doesn't, of course, I mean, it doesn't surprise me, but as far as, I feel like that barely made a blip, and that was even like, because they're now on record saying no, all 22 being like, no, we do not want to repeal a law that is
from 1849.
We
think this is good law.
So it's that, and it's, you know, I heard this question this morning because on the floor yesterday, Robin Voss, as they were, the assembly was debating and voting on the budget, which they didn't take any amendment, the Democratic amendments.
Of course.
Not shocking. And now it is at Eber's desk. I don't know if we'll get news today, but tomorrow is July 1st. So Governor Eber's, I think, said yesterday that they were still looking, you know, they had to look at it and probably line item veto it as much as they can muster, which is very, you know, it's a very Oplander way to put that. So we'll see. We'll see if he, you know, I think everyone's still thinking it'd be pretty unprecedented if he were to veto it altogether. But I got a email this morning from Matt Rothschild, who is about to retire, but he's still obviously working, from Wisconsin Democracy Project. But he, there was a letter, open letter to Governor Evers, signed by a bunch of different organizations in Wisconsin, all in Wisconsin, Wisconsin Public Education Network, League of Women Voters, We Can, Fair Wisconsin, Voces de la Frontera, Citizen Action, Wisconsin for Fair Maps, Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, not project, I said that wrong, asking the governor to veto the whole bill.
Wow. I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen either, but that was a tangent from saying, on the floor, Voss said yesterday, he's like, I think that we are representing the people.
Oh, he said, we know what they want.
We know what they want.
We know what you want.
And I was listening to a different program this morning where a Republican was saying, well, they have the supermajority.
That's because of the gerrymandering.
But, you know, that is their justification for they are in lockstep with their voters. This is what they want. And that thus, like, polling be damned.
Decades of minority rule, you guys.
And I want to be careful sometimes with that. And this is probably a bag to open with 4 minutes left in the show that
right.
is dangerous. But, you know, when we talked to John Johnson 2 weeks ago,
I think, yeah,
who is a research fellow at Marquette, and he was, you know, kind of giving the reality check of if neutral maps are drawn, it's still likely a Republican legislature.
Would it be a supermajority, though?
Probably, no, I don't think it would not be a supermajority. But as far as, you know, between the power of incumbency, how polarized we've segregated ourselves based on political leanings. But I do want to be careful that, like, even if we get new maps, that we're not going to...
It's not going to be a panacea.
Yeah, like,
and
it's still Republicans
sure.
could still very much have one or both chambers.
Right.
And so, but it also just feels like until there's more political ramifications from Republicans who don't agree with the extreme measures that the Republicans that are elected are taking, or and same thing with independents in any of those districts, like until some of this popular stuff that they don't necessarily agree with. All abortions are illegal, or they do want us to get somewhere with medical marijuana, or they do want us to like not have permitless carry, and all of these different things. Like, until they override that and like hold their nose and vote for a Democrat instead of just voting down party lines, no matter how extreme some of the Republicans who are running are, like, I think we have to brace ourselves for the fact that even if we got new maps, that not everything's going to be like a utopia.
Well, but again, a lot of it is about messaging, and a lot of it is about people understanding who is responsible. So the next time there's a mass shooting, God forbid, I hope there's never another one. The next time there is, and all the Republicans come out and say, it's healthcare, it's mental health, it's our children's mental health. Well, they just cut mental health care from governor's budget. They just cut child care counts from the governor's budget. I don't want to hear about how they're the party of life. It's baloney.
Yeah. Well, to end on a high note, since we did have James Maloff on earlier when talking about WFHR, congratulations to Pam Hilke up in WFHR.
Yes, our friend Pam.
This week marks her anniversary when she was first hired at the station in 1977.
Wow.
She's been in the radio game almost as long as you. When was your first job?
1981.
So, yeah.
Pretty close.
Not that she was doing on-air stuff, but like...
She's been a mainstay.
Yes. And so, congratulations on your anniversary, Pam.
Absolutely.
We appreciate you.
We hope to get up there one of these days.
That's true. What do you have planned this weekend?
I am going to be staying in the house and away from the heat.
It is hot.
It's really hot. And I think I have successfully... neglected my hanging potted plant long enough, so now it's dead.
Oh.
So I'm ahead of my usual curve.
Do you have experience, and then we'll close out the show. So I have a hanging fern that I've kept alive.
Okay.
And there is a nest in there with 5 eggs.
Oh.
And luckily the mama bird is not aggressive, like she has not attacked
me. That's because they're not hatched yet.
Okay. Because what should I do? Because like she flies, I can see her fly out every time because it's right on our front door. So every time I leave my front door, she flies out. But I'm a little nervous once these things hatch.
Is it a robin?
I don't think so. It's small.
Okay. Then I don't think you have to worry so much.
I can still water the plant, right?
Oh, I would be curious. Not once the babies come. Not once they hatch.
Okay. So maybe.
Because you're gonna force them to fledge.
The fern may be sacrificed.
It might be goodbye, fern.
All right.
Goodbye, fern. Hello, chicks.
All right. Well, thank you for texting and calling and being a part of the show today and every day. Have a wonderful weekend. This has been As Goes Wisconsin. We'll see you on Wednesday. Have a very great holiday. See you then.